Welcome into your Monday morning commute edition of the Locked On Nets podcast. Glad we can make your day a little bit less bleary, recapping the Nets 132-112 loss to the Indiana Pacers. We're going to talk another semi-disappointing performance from D'Lo, Caris LeVert's continued star turn, and a major issue with turnovers. That next on the Locked On Nets podcast.
You are Locked On Nets, your daily Brooklyn Nets podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
You are Locked On Nets, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your daily Brooklyn Nets micropod. As always, shout out to any new listeners. I know there's at least three of you. Thank you for indulging us and tuning into this Nets podcast. I gotta say, weird time to join. Nets coming off a 20-point loss, but hey, whatever you gotta do. I'm joined by financial wizard, re-disgruntled Nets fan. He was happy for like a day. Now he's sad. Josh Bass. Josh, how you doing?
Gavin, I'm good. I'd like to say that I was happy exactly 28 times last year, each for the number of Nets wins.
This year, now that they can tank, are you going to be happy even when they lose? I know I just hinted that you aren't, but...
Yeah. I'm actually pretty fine with last game. I think they just lost to a superior team, and obviously having the draft pick and getting farther and farther removed from the infamous Billy King trade just makes me a little bit happier.
All right. I feel like you were like kind of on the edge of the building at the end of the first game.
I was pretty upset about that.
Yeah, but it's good. I think you like... And then the second game, you were like, oh, okay, they're fine. And then this third game, you're like, ah, what the hell?
I think I was more mad at the second game, actually, just because they were playing such a terrible team in the Knicks' current roster.
Oh, okay.
And they like blew a big lead, and the Knicks were taking control, and they got kind of lucky at the end to pull that one out. But I also spent a decent chunk of time watching LeVert's highlights from the first three games of the season. So that is why I'm in a particularly chipper mood today.
To your point on that Knicks game, and this is insane. They mentioned this on the Yes broadcast, and it blew my mind. Did you realize, and you watched the game, so you probably heard the same thing I did, so I assume you did realize, the Nets had the third worst points off turnover margin ever in a win in NBA history against the Knicks. They were a minus 20, and they still won the game. And the worst of all time is minus 22, and that was like the Denver Nuggets in the early 90s.
I actually didn't realize that because I was watching with a few friends. So unfortunately, people don't take my seriousness for basketball
seriously?
The same way.
Yeah.
And they're talking during the game about meaningless stuff. I mean, not meaningless because Big Mouth's a great TV show.
Sure.
But let's prioritize a little bit, fellas.
I know. They don't have our passion. All right, so this was, I mentioned the turnover stat. This was also the Nets' eighth straight loss against the Indiana Pacers. We said it last podcast, the Pacers seemed to sort of have the Nets' number. Like, even last year when they played them close a few times, they couldn't seem to pull it out. Obviously, Jeremy Lin suffered that traumatic season-ending injury against Indiana last time around. It was also continued a long, really shockingly bad streak for the Nets. They haven't won a back-to-back involving a flight since 2015, and obviously those games are kind of built to lose, but the fact that they haven't won one of them in three, maybe four seasons now is really just insane to me.
Yeah, because also you could expect that they would win maybe the first part of a back-to-back on the road, then travel home and beat a team. I think it also comes down to the Nets rest a lot of players on back-to-backs, especially when they had Brooke Lopez. That last year, he was resting pretty often on back-to-backs, so he was really their only reliable scorer at that time, and obviously having a bunch of guys who are injury-prone or just have minor things here and there, the Nets are pretty cautious, so that could attribute to the stat you mentioned, but it is pretty shocking. I mean, you have to win back-to-backs in this league to really be a decent playoff-contending team. And until you do that, you're just a team with a lot of potential that's going to wind up in the lottery.
And that's a good way to describe the Nets right now. All right, again, they fall 132-112 to the Indiana Pacers. And for the second game in a row, I think it was an issue against the Pistons too. Turnovers were really the culprit in this one. 5 minutes left in the third quarter, when the Nets were still relatively in this game, they were down 22-3 in points off turnover margin, which is just boggles my mind. And you just can't do that against the team with Indiana's talent, who has a player in Victor Oladipo, who's borderline All-NBA. You can make a case for them having the best bench in the NBA. I kind of slept on them when we were having that conversation in the preseason, but they are certainly in that mix. And that's just a death sentence, and eventually it resulted in the Nets getting blown out.
Yeah, it's two things. I mean, oftentimes it was maybe one of the guards. LeVert was a culprit in this. D'Lo as well. Same with Spencer Dinwiddie. Kind of driving wildly into the lane, kicking it back out for a pass that was getting intercepted. So now they're behind in the play. And then Indiana's guards are super fast. I mean, Oladipo's obviously amazing, insane athlete. Collison is one of the fastest guards in the league. He might not be as quick as he was when he first came in, but he's still really fast and can get up there. And then they have guys like McDermott and Bojan Bogdanovic, who, as we know, is really good at spotting up at the three-point wings and corners on a fast break. So they have a team that's meant to kill you in transition, and they did that. And again, just a bad balance on the Nets in transition defense, sloppy turnovers, that can't happen, especially against a team like Indiana.
Yeah, and I want to give a shout-out to Tyreke Evans, too, in that mix, because to me, he's always had like a little mini LeBron to his game. Like, when he gets into transition, he's not necessarily dunking over people, but guys just like bounce off of him. Like, he'll just like euro step and like dislodge a defender, and it was really difficult for the Nets to contend with. Like, when the Pacers had their bench in, that's typically last season when the Nets would have made a run and maybe got a lead that the starters could blow later on, but they would have gotten a lead. And Tyreke Evans kind of shut that down and was like, nah, we're going to control this. And to me, part of the issue, just as it was against the Knicks, is obviously, as you mentioned, this is twofold. It's not only that they're committing a ton of turnovers offensively, they're not forcing a lot on the defensive end. And to me, that kind of goes back to the scheme the Nets played. Obviously, we mentioned it all offseason. Just in terms of the types of shots they force from opponents, they're really, really good. But I think to do that, you have to play extraordinarily conservative on defense. And outside of Caris LeVert, no one's really capable of jumping passing lanes and making plays on the ball. And that manifests itself in very low turnover results. And for an offense that doesn't have a ton of explosiveness and can get as stagnant as the Nets does, I think you need those fast break opportunities to really compete with some of the better teams in the league.
Yeah, I mean, like, looking at who the Nets were starting at, who've started at the forward positions for the Nets these first three games, Joe Harris and Jared Dudley. I mean, point to that to why they're not forcing a lot of turnovers. Compare that to last year when the 3 and 4 was Damari Carroll and RHJ, and obviously you're going to see more turnovers there, more turnovers created, even though the Nets did do a great job at that last year. And then coming off the bench, I mean, Alan Crabb's not a super physical guy. Korek is very aggressive, but he's needs to channel that a bit better. So I think that hopefully this is a problem that gets somewhat more alleviated once RHJ and Damari Carroll, and even Shabazz Napier, who's a decent ball hawk, come back. But looking at the current Nets and who are playing right now, it makes sense why they're not forcing a lot of turnovers.
I will give a quick shout out to Caris LeVert, and we're going to get more into his game later on in the podcast. But he had one brilliant defensive play that almost made up for a lot of wrongs the Nets did on the night. He jumped into a passing lane that he really like had no right even getting close to. Ball was going out of bounds. He makes another jump, just flips it up the court, and it ended in a transition layup for Brooklyn. So hopefully that inspires the rest of these guys, but I tend to agree with you. It's going to come down to better personnel and Damari Carroll and Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, who will be back next game against Cleveland, making a big difference. All right, let's take our first break, come back, finish recapping this one, and then get into some individual player breakdowns that next on the Locked On Nets podcast. Peak ticket season in New York is fast approaching, and we know that you want to be a part of it. The NFL is in full swing, the Yankees are getting ready for a playoff run, and hockey and basketball are just around the corner. And there's no better option to get a great deal on attending any of those events than Vivid Seats. Vivid Seats allows you to sort by price or look for seats in the section and row of your choice. To make things even better, Vivid Seats is giving listeners an exclusive promo code for $20 off orders of $200 or more to save you even more money. Go to the App Store or Google Play and download the Vivid Seats app. Then use promo code LOCKEDON for $20 off orders of $200 or more. Every purchase is backed by a 100% buyer guarantee. From the biggest concerts and games to the hottest theater and more, Vivid Seats has it all. Download the app and enter promo code LOCKEDON for $20 off orders of $200 or more. That's LOCKEDON. Make a memory that lasts a lifetime and let Vivid Seats help you get to your favorite live event. You are Locked On Nets. All right, Josh, let's finish recapping this game. The Pacers won it 132-112, their eighth consecutive win over the Brooklyn Nets. And Brooklyn was relatively in this one. They got off to a fairly strong start. They shot 8 of 14 on their first, you guessed it, 14 three-point attempts. And their hot shooting kept them in it, even though they weren't necessarily running great offense or taking the best shots.
Yeah, I mean, they hit a ton of threes. Joe Harris especially hit his first five, finished 5 of 6 on the night. They were making a lot of tough shots. I think that the offense generally looked pretty good, definitely not as crisp as it did the first quarters of the first two games because Jarrett Allen struggled a bit with catching the ball and finishing inside. He missed a couple easy layups, and it just seemed that they were a bit stagnant after a back-to-back. But I don't think the offense was the problem in this one. I mean, there were times where they could have gotten better looks. D'Angelo Russell, in particular, I thought forced a few shots. Spencer Dinwiddie didn't have his best game either. And then again, the turnovers were sloppy. But I think when the Nets got shots, they were, for the most part, hitting them down. I mean, if you hit 16 threes in a game, you should expect to win.
Right. And obviously, that hot shooting wasn't totally sustained. They finished just 8 of their last 23. But as you kind of mentioned, that wasn't the— you shouldn't need to shoot better than 43% on nearly 40 three-point attempts to be in a game. And obviously, and we can get into this more later, like, the pace was really high for this game, as it has been throughout the entirety of the NBA this season, so that was part of it. But the defense was just really atrocious at points. The Nets really couldn't survive in pick and roll. I thought D'Angelo Russell regressed a little bit. There was a play, it was essentially like once the game was already over, but it was still really frustrating. Like, there was a pick and roll with Oladipo, and I can't remember who the big was for. It might have been Ike Anibogu getting some action. And Kenneth Faried comes in, first action as a Net, and he just lets Oladipo pop an open three. And look, I get it to a degree. Like, if Faried presses up on him, Oladipo's going to drive to the basket, and, like, your best-case scenario is he breaks down the defense and someone else misses a tray. But it was just frustrating to see, like, Faried, like, not know the scouting report and give Oladipo, like, a 40% three-point shooter, like, that open of a shot.
Yeah, I mean, the game was so out of hand by then. I don't really care too much.
No, but I just thought it was emblematic of the entire night.
Yeah, I guess. I think the defense was just— it wasn't physical enough from the guards. I think there was a problem with D'Lo, who's been maligned for his defensive effort, but also Dinwiddie and LeVert. I don't think they were physical enough. I mean, LeVert had a couple possessions where he really engaged and tried to lock down. I think he did a good job. The only person whose defensive effort on the perimeter I was consistently impressed with was Kuritz. Everyone else was pretty lackadaisical, not only in pick and roll defense, but even just regular perimeter defense. They were getting blown by without even a screen. I mean, Tyreke Evans, Darren Collison were just getting to the rim at will for layups or getting fouls whenever they wanted to.
Yeah, and Jared Allen certainly didn't have his typical game in terms of altering shots or blocking shots.
He's a step slow a lot of times.
Yeah, and then offensively, like, he wasn't all that physical around the rim. So I don't know what the issue was, but it was maybe some bumps left by Enes Kanter, but it certainly wasn't his typical effort. And at this point, with the type of shot blocker and intimidator he's turned into, the Nets are really, really reliant on him playing great. And you can argue that's unfair for a guy only in his second year in the NBA and a guy who didn't have a ton of basketball experience before that, at least relatively. But he kind of has to be that guy for Brooklyn, like, especially without Rondae Hollis-Jefferson and Carroll, because teams are just inevitably going to get into the lane with the type of players the Nets put out there. They're just not going to be great defensively on the perimeter, and that's— they can get as physical as they want, but there's a cap on how good they can be on that side of the floor.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, it's hard to attribute who the problem was, really. Was it Allen for not getting there, or was it the guards' fault for just providing so little resistance that Allen didn't even have time to get there? And really the expectation is that they can at least slow them down enough where Allen has the time to read and dissect the play to get in position to contest. But the defensive effort just really was not there. I'm surprised Kenny Atkinson— I feel like it wasn't really that bad until the second or third quarter, but he didn't seem to, like, call any of the quick timeouts or just get really in guys' faces that you'd expect for a coach when the effort's not there. And I think he's shown that he's capable of doing that in the first 2 years. But he seemed to just wanted to play it out and see what was going to happen.
Yeah, I think one of the key sequences of the game, I think it was the score was like 59-58. And Indiana went on this 8-0 run to end the first half. And the Nets could never really get it close. Like, it kind of—
yep.
Went between, like, Indiana being up 14 points, and that's what get it back to, like, 8 or 6, but they could never really break through after that. And at one point during that sequence, I think he did call a timeout, but I just remember this really, like, frustrating run of plays where the Nets had all these opportunities to score and they kept making these boneheaded mistakes. Like there was one where I think they got a rebound and someone just like tipped it out of bounds. Like when it was,
yeah, only, that was when LeVert and D'Lo
right.
didn't communicate and both went for the rebound, went out of bounds. Oladipo ends up hitting a three in that possession. Next time down the court for the Nets, D'Lo and LeVert again, miscommunication. D'Lo throws the ball essentially right into Oladipo's hand, who takes it all the way down for a dunk, and all of a sudden the lead was up to 8 points by then.
And that was essentially the game. And then the Nets got it, like, I think they cut it to six at the end of the third quarter, and Rodions gets a rebound off a missed free throw, and he just brought the ball down, which is something you just absolutely cannot do in the NBA. You're going to lose it.
No, I think the problem was he kept it up.
The announcer said, I don't know. Maybe I misremembered it.
Instead of dribbling it back out or securing it first, he kept it up and it got poked away.
Okay, either way, Kurucs loses the ball. Tyreek goes coast to coast. And to me, that was like, I already knew the score. So that was why I thought, okay, game over. But even if I didn't, I think you got the sense that, like, all right, Indiana's just going to run away with this one.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing was Bojan Bogdanović and Doug McDermott combined for 7 of 8 on threes. I mean, those guys just weren't missing. And a lot of them were backbreakers. The Nets would cut it to 4 or 5, and they'd hit a three. The lead would be 7 or 8, and they'd hit a couple more and really put the game out of reach. And I think that was the big key. I mean, Indiana shot 16 of 24 on threes. A lot of that is just due to the Nets being unlucky. But also, you have to have some better contests, because you're not going to be able to win games when the other team shoots 67% from three.
Yeah, and that just goes back to our initial problem, because if you can't stop penetration, obviously, then you suck and help defense. The Pacers have a bunch of good guards. They have a bunch of really intelligent guards, and that leads to guys like McDermott and, to a lesser degree, Bojan, who aren't necessarily great at creating their own shot, but they're elite shooters, and you give them good look after good look, they're going to take advantage of it repeatedly. All right, let's get into the individual player breakdowns a little bit. D'Angelo Russell, a slightly better night scoring the ball, but still kind of disappointing, only 5 of 16 from the field. And that tells you how well his season's gone when I'm saying that, and he still only had 12 points in 30 minutes. Did have 7 assists, 6 rebounds, but all in all, a frustrating night for him. And I think this really drove home what we've been saying about him for 2 years, that he's, and maybe ding me for giving him too much credit for a strong preseason, but I really had high expectations for him developing into if not an elite scorer, a really good one this season. And he just doesn't have that explosiveness. Like, all the shots he made were just these tough looks off him being clever and smart and making shots with guys in his face, but that's just, like, not sustainable if you want to be a great scorer in this league.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, my thoughts on D'Angelo Russell are pretty well documented. It's tough because, as you mentioned, he's not a great athlete, doesn't have the first step to beat his man. He's not that good of a shooter. Also, he shies away from contact. The times when he is crafty enough to get into the lane, he'll release the ball with his offhand farther from the defender to shield him away, but also just release this, like, soft, like, floater thing, which just ensures there's no chance he gets a foul called. So he's not doing himself a favors on that front. So even when he is able to put up points, because he can get hot in a hurry, it's usually not an efficient night. I mean, 12 points on 16 shots, it's abominable. So he needs to do better, point blank.
And I think the bottom line for me is, at this point, we're only 3 games into the season, so you could argue this is premature, but I think it's pretty readily apparent who the guy taking the most shots on this team should be, and that's Caris LeVert. I think you pretty clearly, like, LeVert should be the guy taking 16 shots. Russell should be taking more like 9. And to a degree, that's on LeVert to be a little bit more aggressive, because this game he shot 8 for 9. He literally was almost flawless from the floor, had these incredible plays. Like, that one in the third quarter where he just went right at Oladipo really stands out to me. And Oladipo covers him super well. And then he just has this reverse pivot, one step, double pump in the lane that's just absolutely absurd. And that's going against one of the best perimeter defenders in the NBA, and it's just this, like, little moment that you're like, okay, Caris LeVert is really something, and he just has all these tools and the size and the touch that D'Lo lacks, and I think all those factors just lead me to believe he should be the dominant offensive player on this team.
Yeah, but to make that happen, you need a point guard who really is pass first, and I don't know if D'Angelo Russell is that. He's still trying to figure out what he's going to be. Is he a pass first point guard? Is he a point guard that's going to look for his own shot first and then get others involved? What are his core competencies? What is he really going to succeed with in this league? And I think until D'Lo figures that out, it's always going to be a bit awkward to figure out who's going to be the guy between him and LeVert, because D'Lo is the second overall pick. He was the guy come to first the Lakers, then to Brooklyn, expected to be the savior in both franchises, and he just hasn't been so far. And for LeVert, a guy who's gotten a ton better since his rookie year in the league, overcame a lot of injuries at Michigan, it's still, I think he's still finding his place and blossoming into that lead option.
All right, I'll qualify this take by saying, once again, I was super high on D'Lo coming into the season, and I'm super low on him now, and the truth probably lies somewhere in the middle. But do you think there'll come a point this season where the Nets have to ask themselves the really tough question if they're honestly just a better team with Spencer Dinwiddie and Shabazz Napier playing the point guard minutes?
I think there will be a time where the Nets will have to at least ask themselves that question, but that's not going to be till, I'd say, maybe even close to the All-Star break, because D'Lo being a restricted free agent, this is the year for the Nets to see whether he has it or he doesn't. I mean, he's either going to be on this team for the foreseeable future as a key building block, or he won't be on at all. There's no halfway point. So the Nets have to give him every opportunity to see what he has, let him improve, especially see how he looks with more options at his disposal with Rondé there, with Damari Carroll spotting up at the four spot, getting more reps and getting more comfortable with Jared Allen as a pick-and-roll partner. So I don't know how D'Lo's going to react to that. Do I think he's going to get a ton better from where he is now? No, because I'm not super high on his ability or his potential. But I think the Nets have to at least give him that opportunity to see if he does become a key piece for them.
Yeah, I think he does deserve credit for that. I think when he's out there with Allen, it makes Allen a better offensive player. And maybe the same will be true for Hollis Jefferson and Carroll. And because frankly, we didn't see a large sample size of him with those guys last season. And we haven't seen a large sample size of D'Lo this season. So maybe I'm overreacting. All right, we'll take one final break, come back, break down the rest of the Nets that we want to talk about on Locked On Nets. Is your company looking for a new way to reach customers? Your company could be mentioned right now. Podcast listeners are 60% more likely to interact with sponsors they hear on their podcasts. Our demographic is 98% male and more educated and earning more than traditional media audiences. Have your company sponsor this podcast? Email me at gavinshall14@gmail.com. That is gavinshall14@gmail.com. Third and final segment, Locked On Nets. Gavin Shaw, Josh Bass with you. Hope you're enjoying your Monday morning commute, and we want you guys to have a great day at work, hopefully better than the Nets' effort against these Pacers. Spencer Dinwiddie, he was pretty quiet in this one. I thought I genuinely loved the way he played the first two games of the season. I know I don't remember, but maybe he didn't shoot that well against Detroit, but all in all, I just the way he's been attacking the basket, hasn't been settling for three balls. I've really enjoyed it, and that wasn't really an issue in this one. He was actually 2 of 5 from three-point range. The issue came from 2, where he was just 2 of 6. At one point, missed a point-blank layup at the basket. That was just really surprising, because that's exactly the type of shot he's been finishing with ease this season. But just a little bit of a disappointing effort for him. I'm sure he'll bounce back from it.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, tired legs. Second game in a row, he hasn't shot the ball well. Against Detroit, he was amazing. Really carried the Nets for stretches. But again, 2 of 5 from 3 is good. Just the finishing at the basket has to improve. And also, there was a couple of times where he was complaining with the ref. Meanwhile, the Nets were getting blown by in transition. So let's try to rein that in a bit if possible.
All right, Ed Davis, I thought, again, he was awesome defensively. Mm-hmm.
Really good.
Didn't really play a lot in the second half, but in the first, I thought he was part of the reason the Nets stayed in it. He had a lot of really nice contests on Miles Turner. I thought he did a better job protecting the rim and in help defense than Jared Allen did in this game. He's just smart. He knows where to go. I feel like every time he's out there, he's a net positive. And to that point, I mean, only played 19 minutes, but was only minus one when you look at like a lot of the key guys, and they were minus 24, minus 18, minus 20. So that's a testament to, I think, the impact he had in this game.
Yeah, are you still surprised that we haven't seen at least any minutes of him and Jared Allen together?
Not really. I mean, I just think they're both centers, and I think that just totally nullifies the way the Nets play offensively. Like, yeah, I know Allen hit 2 threes in that first game against the Pistons, but I don't think that's sustainable at this point, and I don't think the Nets are built in such a way that they have the offensive talent at the 1 through 3 spots so they can afford just two guys clogging up the lane.
Yeah, that's fair. I think that with a healthy roster, definitely not in order, but especially with Kurtz going out, I think it would be nice to at least experiment with it, see if there's any magic there and there's some chemistry, because Davis is a very smart player, excellent screener, And Allen, we've seen that he's at least like serviceable from hitting the three in the corner. So I would like to see the geometry of how that would work out if they get a couple minutes together.
And you mentioned Kurucs, and he went out with, I think it was a left, like, twisted ankle. It didn't look like it was anything that severe.
Not awful.
Yep. Yeah, no, it seems like I'm sure he'll be back relatively soon. But another really impactful effort from him, 12 points, 6 rebounds in just 14 minutes, which is just, I would have called you insane if you told me he'd have a stat line like that in the regular season in a game that wasn't a total blowout, at least from the start, because it obviously ended that way. And relatively efficient, 5-9 from the field, 2-5 from three. He did bank in a three that makes his final stat line look quite a bit better. And seems a little bit fluky, but hey, I'll take it. I mean, he's just awesome, and I'm really starting to believe in him as he's an NBA player. He's going to have a career.
Yeah, no, I love Kurucs. I think that I love his confidence because he's just gunning up shots from anywhere. Some of them are pretty bad shot selection, but you have to admire it. He had a couple really nice floaters, takes off the basket, and I like the development from game to game because in that Knicks game, we saw him struggling, or I forget if it was Knicks or Pistons, where he traveled maybe twice, catching the ball, pump faking, and then driving in for layups.
So he's doing that in the preseason.
Had a couple turnover problems there, and then really worked on that to make sure that his footwork was in line, and had a couple nice drives to the basket following pump fakes from the three-point line. So I'm really excited for him. I think he's going to be a big part of the rotation moving forward. The only thing will be seeing where he plays once Rondae Hollis-Jefferson and Damari Carroll are healthy, and that might not be a pressing problem for Kenny Atkinson because who knows how long Damari is going to be out, but I think with a full rotation or full roster available to Atkinson, I'm interested to see if he plays Kurucs more at the four or even tries in some at the three.
Yeah, I think it'll ultimately come down to either him or Jared Dudley, just because the rotation is going to be so loaded at that point.
Well, we should know the answer to that. I mean, that's right. Pretty obvious.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, sure. I mean, like, you would think Kurucs would be the guy, but again, they've started Dudley this whole time, so that lets you know what Atkinson thinks about him. I think what Dudley does as a passer is valuable with all the negative factors he also brings to the court. I'm not sure if it's worth it, but I don't know. I'm intrigued to see what they do.
Yeah, I mean, Dudley might be a better player now. It's arguable, but I think when you're saying Jared Dudley, a 33-year-old forward who will probably be out of the league within the next 2 years and then go either to a very successful career as a coach or as a broadcaster versus Kurucs, who's a 21-year-old rookie, has a lot of potential ahead of him. You want to see what you have in him and if he's going to be a building block moving forward. I think it's pretty obvious, especially when you're not playing for the playoffs right now. I mean, that would be the goal, but it's not something that's pretty likely to see at least what we have out there in Kurucs.
I 100% agree with you. I just don't know if that's where the Nets are at mentally. All right, final two guys. Alan Crabb, 10 points, 2-6 from the field, made some free throws. Pretty nondescript. He just looks like the same guy he was last year, which isn't exciting for me. I'm happy that they're playing Joe Harris over him and they've realized that Joe Harris is better, which we were kind of standing for all of last season. That's really all I have to say about him. I don't think they're going to be able to trade his contract, so that's a bummer.
Yeah, maybe they can this offseason. He was pretty bad. I mean, missed a couple. I feel like he never makes those wide open threes. I mean, it's just such a momentum killer. And three turnovers for a guy who's touching the ball as little as he is, he still has really not developed any ball skills in his 6 years in the league. So it's upsetting, but only two more years of him.
Yay. Zanon Musa got his first ever NBA bucket, and it was a floater. I think when he was in preseason, he only shot floaters and threes, so that wasn't a shocker to me. He made it from just inside the foul line, so that's obviously a little bit of a weapon for him. It's nice to see him out there. I think he's going to spend most of the season in the G League, but shout out to Zanon. I didn't want to end the podcast without mentioning that.
Yep, very happy for Mr. Musa.
Yeah, we're going to throw him a party. All right, the Nets have the Cavs next. They have 3 days off, which is crazy during an NBA season. Obviously, they just had the back-to-back, but that's a really long time. I think we will probably talk about this off air, but we might come back with a preview podcast, maybe give you guys some general thoughts from around the NBA, because I always like doing that and having a wider scope on things on Tuesday. And then I'm sure we'll have a game recap for you Wednesday night, Thursday morning. All right. Thanks for tuning in. Enjoy your week. Hopefully the Nets turn this thing around and soon.